Many people have submitted questions, and we're going to get to as many as we can. I'll read the first question. You've addressed that there is too much relativism, that it's killing the advance in their ability to even recognize what's going on in the world and in this society. Could you elaborate on this? In particular, you've talked about the world can't wait, drive out the Bush regime movement, that this is something that really needs to be done, yet people don't really want to see what's happening. Could you speak more to that also?
The whole notion of relativism, that there is no absolute or objective truth. And, you know, that everything, you know, sometimes popularly put, everything's relative. You know, it's your opinion, my opinion, you know, it's all different narratives, different, you know, it takes also the form of, you know, and relates to the identity politics. Each identity group has their own narrative and their own truth. You know, remember there used to be that T-shirt, it's a black thing, you wouldn't understand. And, you know, and mixing up, like, what is perceptual knowledge from what is conceptual or rational knowledge synthesized to a higher level. It's like, if you remember in the memoir, I discussed this encounter with this guy, D.H., who at one point says, nobody can tell me that who's not black, that they know what it's like to, the same way that I do, what it's like to be black in America. And I responded, well, if you're talking about perceptual knowledge, I agree. If you're talking about conceptual knowledge, I don't agree. Whoom. You know, because this is going straight up against the nationalism and the related relativism and identity politics, you know, that instead of there being, you know, I talked about, you know, our universalism ideologically. It embraces but does not replace. But it does embrace, you know, and you know, it can be applied and needs to be applied to every sphere, you know, and that is a reflection of the fact that, you know, reality on the one hand exists in the form of matter in motion in particular forms, not one uniform, undifferentiated matter moving around somehow. So there is particularity, as Mao said, there's particularity of contradiction. Different fields of human endeavor have to do with different forms of matter and motion in a fundamental sense. But then again, all these things, while they're discrete, you know, while they do have their own identity, in other words, that's what discrete means, they're separate with their own identity, that's not absolute, it's relatively so. See, this is where it gets complicated, because there's relativism, but there's also, as Lenin said, there is an element of relativism in dialectical materialism, but it is not relativist. Now, what did he mean by that? He meant that, as he put it another way he put it was that the boundaries in nature and society are real but relative. I'm paraphrasing. They're real, but they're conditional and relative. In other words, they're not absolute. One state of matter and motion interconnects and interpenetrates with others and is mutually influencing with others and gives rise to another form. Otherwise, there would be no, if the discrete separate forms of matter and motion were absolute, there never could be a change from one form of matter and motion to another. And in fact, this happens all the time. And when you look at such a change, to take an example I've often given, if you look at the change between water and ice, there is a definite state of being water, and there's a definite state of being ice. And if you jump into a swimming pool full of ice, you'll be reminded of the difference. But it's relative. When the ice begins to melt, you know, there is these sort of transitional stages. So the boundary's not absolute. You know, or running and walking. You know, in the Olympics, they have the official event of walking, and there is a qualitative difference. There are certain things they define according to the rules. You're not allowed to have both feet off the ground. You know, it's interesting, technology and knowledge. For example, it didn't used to be known that when human beings and other animals run, they actually run with their feet off the ground at the same time. When they started developing photography more, they actually got some photographs of horses running with all of their legs off the ground at the same time. And, you know, this may have been known by scientists, but it became popularly known and understood then. So that between walking and running, not to get too far afield, is a real qualitative distinction, but it's relative. It's not absolute, and the one can go into the other. So there is an element of relativism, but there are discrete forms of matter and motion that have their particular properties and their own particular forms of motion, to put it another way, and they can be understood as such, and their interrelations can be understood, and reality can be investigated, and truths can be determined about reality. In other words, what is a truth? It is human understanding that is in line with how objective reality really is. But, you know, I always feel like saying to a lot of these people in academia who, you know, are into all this postmodernism and deny that they're, including a bunch of professors, you know. You know, I've had discussions with people and I'm stomping my feet. How the fuck can they say this stupid stuff about how there's no truth, you know? And, you know, like and I always feel like saying to them, well, then why do you bother with footnotes and citing sources if there's no objective truth? Why do you bother with even quoting anybody? Just make up whatever you want. Why in academia do you insist that people give sources and citations for what they're writing? If there's who cares whether they make their case or not, if there's no case to be made anyway. If it's all just, you know, different narratives, then why do you have to offer in effect proofs for anything in any field? So there is objective truth because there is objective reality, and human beings are capable, not perfectly and not entirely, but they are capable of understanding, correctly reflecting, or in a close enough approximation of correctly reflecting to say that this is an actual understanding of reality as it really is, and therefore it's truth. And so, in opposition to that, when you start talking about, you know, there isn't any truth, there's just different narratives, first of all, on a basic epistemological level, you're out of line with reality, you know, and you're actually out of line with how you have to work your way through and engage the world. In practice, you're forced to act according to the opposite conclusion all the time. In practice, you're forced to act as if there is actually objective truth. You know, I mean, I know some people in some places, like New York City perhaps, they regard traffic lights as advisory rather than obligatory. But, you know, nonetheless, if you proceed into an intersection while there's a bunch of cars coming the other way with the green light, you are going to have the reality imposed on you in a very violent way. So in life, people are forced to act in accord with the fact that there is objective truth, but philosophically, they can raise all kinds of objections to it, you know, from different angles, like, you know, Immanuel Kant basically put something forward philosophically akin to positivism, that you can only really know the perception of something, never the thing behind the perception. And Engels and Lenin point out that, use the example of coal tar, for example, when human beings began to be able to synthesize that and could actually make the ding an sich, you know, the thing in itself, then this put the rest to the idea, or should have put to rest the idea, that you couldn't know the thing behind the perception, because human beings were actually making the thing. So there's a whole thing about that in Lenin's Materialism and Imperial Criticism, which I won't go into further here. But the point is that, so it's wrong philosophically. But also then the implications of it, you know, are paralyzing. And they lead to being unable in the political sphere, or they go along with being unable and in some, even some ways unwilling to come to, first of all, to come to grips with what's really happening. And second of all, to unify people on the basis of actually struggling over what's really true. And how do you understand what's true in relation to all different kinds of particularities, all different kinds of particular forms of matter in motion, and how do you get a correct synthesis that it correctly ties all that together so you can see the whole picture of what's happening and what it's all rooted in. And without being able to do that, how can you really act in an effective way? How can you even know how you should act and what you should be trying to effect, let alone actually do that? So it's paralyzing. And, it becomes a rationale often for not doing anything. If you can't really, you talk about World Can't Wait, for example. I mean, I don't want to be melodramatic. But there's a certain urgency. Well, not a certain, there's a definite urgency here. We don't have many times to keep trying to do what World Can't Wait is setting out to do. You know, they're marching down the road here. I mean, I gave this talk about, or these comments about, how the fascists in the U.S. are going after the equivalent of the Weimar Republic, the bourgeois Democrats, and what the significance of that is, and here how you have to understand it from our point of view and where we're trying to go, not from the point of view of defending bourgeois democracy as an end in itself or as the objective, but How do you understand why that's happening? Why are they going after the Weimar Republic, and how should we view that and act in relation to that from our largest strategic objectives? And this is very important to understand. Cheney and Bush and this guy King in New York are going after the New York Times. This is an example of attacking the Weimar Republic. The New York Times is a very major institution of a section of the ruling class in this country, which more or less by analogy is sort of the bourgeois democratic representative of the, analogous to the Weimar Republic in Germany during the 20s and early 30s before it was destroyed by the rise to power of the Nazis. And here's where things get very complex politically. You know, it may, if these things keep sharpening up with the New York Times, it may fall to us to wage the defense of the New York Times from the correct perspective of where we're seeking to take everything. But this who gives a fuck? I once was talking to some people and I was talking about how I read something in the New York Times, and one of these people actually said, well, and this is someone who considers themselves a communist, and they said, well, I don't know why anyone would even read the New York Times. After all, it's a bourgeois publication. I was rather taken aback by that. Not exactly a correct understanding of embraces but does not replace. But, besides the fact that there are things you can learn from the New York Times, positively and negatively, it's also the fact that if you just allow this section of the ruling class to knock down the New York Times on these terms, what is the effect of that going to be on everything that we're trying to do, even short of revolution, for example, with World Can't Wait, and then in broader terms? So I'm getting a little bit of field here, but from the question about relativism, but it does actually interrelate. Because the consequences of, there is no objective truth, it's all different narratives, goes along with, I refuse to believe that I'm being ruled over. This couldn't happen here. I mean, one thing I have to say is we have published repeatedly, and for good reason, that Pastor Niemöller statement. A couple of things should be said about that. One, note what has been written out of history. Note the first sentence of that. First they came for the whom? For the communists. That's been written out of the whole history of the Nazis and everything in bourgeois democratic circles and in the bourgeois accounts of history in general. It's either been shunted to the side or completely written out. But the other thing is, I have to say, with a certain amount of, shall we say, intense irony, is that the point of the Niemöller statement and his point in making it and our point in popularizing is not so that people can set about repeating it, which it seems some people are determined to do. I didn't resist when they went after this group and that group because it wasn't me. In other words, I was, you know, let's put it slightly less charitably, I was looking out for my own ass. When they came after the professors and started taking the Jewish professors out of the university, I didn't do anything. Well, what's the parallel, you know, today with the Ward Churchills and the professors at Columbia University who are being attacked for being critical of the state of Israel, which is being made into beyond the pale? Poets are disinvited from universities because they've written and said things critical of the state of Israel. Not even saying the state of Israel shouldn't exist, just critical of the state of Israel. And if you're mired in relativism, well, you know, who knows what's true? Maybe the Israeli narrative of how the state of Israel came about and what role it plays in the world is true for the Israelis, and the Palestinian narrative is true for the Palestinians. Well, then how can you act in relation to that? And the other thing to understand is whether people consciously draw the conclusion or not, the logical extension of relativism is that right makes right, might makes right. Because if it's all just a bunch of narratives, then which narrative prevails in the world is the one that has the most power behind it. If you can't distinguish between narratives, if it's, you know, of such and such thing and you wouldn't understand, and these narratives, by the way, come into conflict with each other. The Palestinian narrative is in conflict with the Israeli narrative. The Native American narrative is in opposition to the official American narrative, even though it's had to make certain concessions about genocide. It's still a different narrative. Well, you know, is this all narratives or is there truth here? And if there's no truth, then how in the real world do these conflicting narratives, because they are conflicting, which one then prevails and how does that get decided? It gets decided by power relations. Now, nevertheless, in the real world, reality will assert itself. So simply having more power than someone else, people who have developed these theories, that it's simply a matter of having more power, and that way you can, you know, have applied, you know, the Huey Newton, you know, line about power resides in the ability to define phenomena and cause them to act in the, you know, in the desired manner. Or, you know, other theorists who, in a more elaborate way, have put out basically that it's just a matter of power defining reality. That's not true either, because there is reality. It asserts itself, and it asserts itself in the ways that we've been speaking about in terms of how human beings come together, under what circumstances, under what coercion and necessity to form a society, how that's historically determined, how it gives, you know, takes form in certain production relations, generally in correspondence with the character of the productive forces at a given time, which in turn gives rise to a superstructure, and all this being dynamic and changing. All these underlying dynamics and contradictions assert themselves regardless of the power relations, or not regardless of them, but underneath the power relations. Otherwise, there could never be a revolution to change the power relations. Or it would simply be who has more power, and how would you go from having less power to having more power, other than by will, I guess. So reality will assert itself, but this kind of a notion of it's all different narratives and all different truths, and it's all a matter of opinion, will paralyze you and or lead you into a logic of whoever can impose their narrative on others is, well, what can you say about it? That's just the way it is. So it leads again to paralysis if you don't like the narrative that's being imposed. Now, the truth doesn't set you free by itself. But on the other hand, you're not ever going to get fully free without the truth. That's another contradiction that we should understand. So, and right now, there's the last point I'll say about this. There's another dimension to this. Now, we are up against an absolutist core of the ruling class, which promotes religious fundamentalism and absolutism and other forms. You know, that what they insist on, their narrative, their version of reality, is true, and it's true tautologically. It's true by circular logic. And it's true by a higher logic than the methods of science, for example, can penetrate. Bush did not lie about Iraq because he's Bush, this is America, and that's not a lie. Or in the Christian fascist version, he's serving a higher truth. God and Christ against the Antichrist. You know, and you hear, by the way, some of this. See, and but yet this absolutism is mixed in with its own form of relativism. You think about General Jerry Boykins. This is a false God. How do we know? Because my God is more powerful than that God. Then it becomes a contest of narratives backed up by however many weapons of mass destruction and slaughter that you have on the side of your narrative. My God is more powerful than their God, said Jerry Boykins, whereupon he was promoted. So they have a form of absolutism, but it also contains an element of relativism, and they promote relativism under certain circumstances. I pointed this out before. They especially promote relativism and even forms of modernism in general in opposition to science. And for evolution is a very sharp example of that. If it's all just different narratives, then what's to choose between the biblical version of creation and the scientifically established fact of evolution? And if you can't establish something like evolution by scientific methods, then creationism is just as valid, if not a more valid, explanation of what evolution, in fact, actually explains. So they promote and wield relativism to attack truths that are, you know, I don't want to sound like Al Gore, but truths that are inconvenient for them. Truths that are an impediment, an obstacle to what they're setting out to do. But at the same time, they have a very absolutist core about this whole thing. And the relativism that characterizes so much of the progressive forces and the progressive intellectuals is just killing and paralyzing. And a direct fetter, a direct shackle, a direct chain, a direct obstacle to their being mobilized and working to mobilize others to oppose, you know, these very heavy things that are being brought forward. It's like I said, with World Can't Wait, we don't have a lot of time here. I mean, everything that's been brought forward that there was an outcry over is being institutionalized. Oh, you're spying on people's conversation? Institutionalized. We're taking other people to other countries to torture them. Little outcry. There it is. It's part of the fabric now. Like Cheney, you know, get used to it. This is part of the new normalcy. You know, and if people keep refusing to acknowledge reality and, you know, interconnected with that, clinging to various forms of relativism as one form in which to do that, then it just weakens them, if not outright paralyzes them, in terms of their ability to recognize, first of all, what's actually going on, and second of all, to do anything about it. And we really have to wage a very sharp struggle with people over this epistemologically, on different dimensions. One, we have to struggle with them about communist epistemology, what it is and why it's what everybody should take up, but a lot of people are not going to go all the way with that at a given time, but at least why you have to acknowledge that there's objective truth. I mean, it shouldn't be the case that it's a tip-off that you're somehow associated with the RCP if you use the phrase objective reality in a positive sense. You know, we got to wage an epistemological fight with people that there is objective reality. It's knowable. We can't know all of it at any given time, and we'll never know all of it. But we can know important parts of it, and we should struggle over what's true and not true. not over what I choose to believe because it's convenient and choose not to believe because it's inconvenient. And you can see the interconnection between that epistemological struggle and the political struggle that has to be waged and the ideological struggle over what we're going to do about reality. So this is extreme, and we don't have a lot of time. We've got to wage this struggle with people without panicking, without falling into hype and trying to jack people up in one form or another. We have to struggle very intensely with people because there's great urgency here. You know, and one of the things we have to do is make it just simply not accept it when people say things like, I choose not to believe that. I mean, we can't force them to believe things, but we should make it a point of epistemological struggle that is not acceptable. And I knew someone who was told a story about how they were talking with someone from the middle strata, generally enlightened and somewhat progressive person. They were talking about police brutality, and they were running down all these stories of what the mass is subjected to. And at a certain point, the person said, listen, I don't want to say that you're not telling the truth, but I just choose not to believe you because if I believed you, it would be just too upsetting to me. It would be too challenging to my whole way of life and how I'm relating to things in the world. Well, that should not be acceptable. I mean, I'm not saying we don't have the power to dictate to people, and even if we did, that's not the way we should struggle that through, but it should be epistemologically unacceptable to say, well, I choose not to believe something because it makes me uncomfortable, and I choose to believe something because it makes me comfortable. And you see this isn't just among intellectuals and academics. These ways of thinking are all, you know, among all strata in the society. You go among the basic masses and they say, well, maybe God doesn't exist for you, but I know God exists for me. No. God doesn't exist for anybody. And if God did exist, God would exist for everybody, unless it really were a special God that you just happen to have a special arrangement with. So it's not just, you know, intellectuals and academics, although that's the struggle there is extremely important. And will have its, you know, its effects broadly in society. Intellectuals are another group of people who have disproportionate influence in society. They're a small grouping in society, relatively, but they have an influence out of proportion to their size in the population. Precisely because they do work with ideas, and even though a lot of people resent them and say, you know, don't know what the hell they're talking about half the time, and I think there is, just let me just say, in postmodernism, there is a whole strain of deliberately trying to talk so hardly anybody can figure out what the hell you're talking about. And that's a broader tendency in academia, but it's almost a principle, you know, you have to develop a certain language that, I mean, look, every discipline has certain specialized language. You know, and that's not a negative thing. There's a particularity of matter and motion, and certain terminologies developed to describe it is part of being able to engage and understand that reality and act upon it. But when you deliberately use language that's meant to be obscure, then you've gone from the necessary use of terminology to describe concepts that need to be described over into something else, into deliberate obscurantism. And it sometimes ties in with theories about how, you know, of how there's no objective reality anyway. But intellectuals do have a disproportionate influence, even though a lot of people, you know, when they hear them talk, they say, what the fuck are they talking about? And a lot of them, even the better ones, don't know how to take the knowledge that they legitimately have, the important knowledge they have, and translate it into terms that people who aren't trained in that discipline or aren't experienced in working in that field or working with ideas in general can actually understand, they still have an influence because the theories they develop and the concepts they develop filter their way through the society in different forms and get translated into different ways. And also merge and interpenetrate and reinforce with spontaneous thinking among the masses. So these things exist among all strata. If you're a Dallas Maverick fan, that was a terrible call, but if you're a Miami fan, that was a good call. That form of thinking is all through all sections of the population. And it's a barrier to people actually understanding reality and being able to understand, as I said, why things are the way they are and what to do about it, and to understand who are actually the forces that they should be uniting with, and what are the strengths and limitations of those forces, and who are the forces that they actually need to be going up against, and what are the strengths and weaknesses of those forces, and all that has those political implications as well as the epistemological implications and of actually whether you're understanding, engaging and understanding reality as it actually is, or being walking around and being led around in the dark, which is what most people in the society are doing. By the way, including among the intellectual strata. Even, you know, where they discover important truths, there are significant dimensions in which they're walking around and, you know, in effective darkness in terms of, you know, understanding reality. So there's an epistemological dimension, there's the political implications, and there's the interconnection of the two. And this is poisonous and paralyzing, and that's always true. But the fact that it's true and the way that it's true is acutely posed in a magnified way now, given what's going on. And we have to really be urgently out there taking this on as part of what we're doing. You're not going to win, I mean, not to reduce it down to narrowest terms, but you're not going to win the political struggles that need to be waged and won without waging the struggle in the epistemological and ideological and philosophical realm at the same time. That's acutely true and true in a very magnified and accentuated way now.